You are about to hear a lecture given by Myrtle Smith of Belfast, Ireland, given in Dallas, Texas in March of 1991.
The title of her lecture is Moral Courage. How do we obtain it? Now, I was raised on a farm in West Texas. We have a saying out there that when a person has overcome some difficulty or proved something, they say, I have hoed that row. And believe me, when faced with terrorism and other fears, we have someone here tonight who definitely has hoed the row of facing them with moral courage. Please join me in welcoming Mrs. Myrtle Smith.
Thank you, Tony, for such a warm welcome. And thank you for the music. Wasn't that lovely to hear Danny Boy? I felt quite at home. And I'd like to say a special thank you to the people of Texas for welcoming me here so warmly. You Texans do everything in a big way. You've got such big hearts. I think there's a lot of moral courage right here in Texas, and I'm sure I don't need to lecture the people here about moral courage. It isn't really a lecture. It's a talk. It's a sharing together of things that I, as a Christian Scientist, have learned about moral courage in my own life. I've been learning what it means, its deeper meaning, its deeper insights and values, and how to apply it in many ways in my own life. So I'm grateful for an opportunity just to share that with you, because in the world that we're living in today, with wars, rumors of wars, and all the terrible things that are happening, it appears that we all need to know more about this subject of moral courage. Sometimes when we listen to the news about war, we wonder, is a war right? Was that the right step to take? Well, as I have learned through living in Northern Ireland, sometimes we just have to take the lesser of the two evils. Now, I used to think that moral courage was simply the ability to stand up to error and to speak out and not be afraid. But I find over years in my life that sometimes when we do that, we can hurt and offend people and do more harm than good. So for years, I have been praying to God to teach me more about moral courage, to teach me what it's like, and to teach me how to apply it. Mary Baker Eddy, in her textbook, Science and Health, the Key to the Scriptures, talks a lot about moral courage. And I would like to read just one thing that she says about it, which I like. She says that moral courage is the lion of the tribe of Judah, the king of the mental realm. Free and fearless, it roams in the forest. Undisturbed, it lies in the open field or rests in green pastures beside the still waters. In the figurative transmission from the divine thought to the human, diligence, promptness, and perseverance are likened to the cattle upon a thousand hills. They carry the baggage of stern resolve and keep pace with highest purpose. There she lists many of the qualities that go to make up moral courage. First of all, she said it's free and fearless. Then she says it's undisturbed. It rests in green pastures beside still waters. So moral courage is really a state of being undisturbed by whatever is going on around us, and being feeling free and fearless. And I have learned that it's moral courage to me means being able to pray to God, to listen to Him for direction, and then the ability or moral courage to carry through with whatever God has been directing us to do. Now, you can't have moral courage if you don't have good morals. And it seems that this world that we live in has become so immoral. There's so much promiscuous living, drink, alcohol, drugs, sex abuse, that it seems that if you do not go along with these things, you are considered not to be normal. And that's very hard for our young people to take and for them to live up to. And I find that our teenagers especially need our prayerful support more than ever before. We mustn't give up on them or think that they're worthless. Supposing you knew a young man who had never driven a car in his life, who had never learned the highway code, and he stole a car which was not even roadworthy, and he began driving through the center of Dallas. Can you imagine what would happen? That young man would not only be a danger to himself, but he would be a great danger to everyone that he came in contact with. Now, supposing he came to you and he said, "I've had a terrible accident. Many people have been killed or hurt or injured because of what I've done." Would you say to that young man, "Take the car back to the manufacturer because it's no good"? You would hardly do that. You would tell him it was his own fault. He hadn't learned the highway code. He hadn't been obedient to the code of the road, to the laws of the land. He hadn't even learned how to drive. Yet so many people in the world today are saying, "How did God make this world so bad, so evil? Why don't we take it back to the manufacturer and ask him to sort it out? The manufacturer didn't cause all this havoc. It was our fault for not obeying the moral code." I would like to share an experience that I had in Northern Ireland some years ago, which helped me to get more insight to what moral courage was really all about. It was at the time when the troubles in Northern Ireland were really at their peak, when they were burning buses all the time and cars and causing a lot of havoc in our community. And we hadn't been able to go out for years. There was nothing happening in the evenings, no cinemas open, no restaurants, the buses didn't even run. The town was just like a ghost town, and people were frightened even to go into the city center to shop because of car bombs, and the stores were doing very little trade. Well, one day I had to go into town because I was librarian in the Christian Science reading room. And as I was preparing to get ready, I switched on the radio and I heard a news bulletin. And the news bulletin said that an IRA hunger striker had died in jail in England the night before. This IRA hunger striker wanted to be brought back to Northern Ireland to serve a sentence. And because the authorities wouldn't let him go there, he went on a hunger strike and he died. And because of that, the IRA had promised all sorts of reprisals for that day. So this radio announcement said that most of the stores in town had already shut because a lot of bombs had gone off. They said that most of the big factories had gone home. The shipyard had closed. And all the buses were being taken off the roads. And they advised people to stay at home. Now this was something that was happening all the time in our community. So at first I began to think, well, that's it, I'd better replan my day. But I'm used to taking my day to God. So I went back to God and I said, Father, what should I do with my day? And back came this answer, as clearly as if it had been spoken. It is wrong to allow yourself to be intimidated by any evil force. Now, you couldn't get a clearer message than that. And I began to think, why, that's the truth. I am allowing myself to be intimidated by an evil force calling itself the IRA, which says it can plan my day. It can tell me what I have to do today. Not only is it telling me, it's telling all the people in this province. But this evil force has no power to tell me anything. So I decided I'm going into town and I'm going to do my duty at the reading room. Well, suddenly all these arguments came in and it said, well, you're only being a martyr. You're going into the city centre and even if you get in there, there won't be anyone to come to the reading room. But then I thought about it and I thought, it doesn't matter. If nobody comes, I'll be there and the doors will be open. And I will be carrying out my trust in God by not allowing myself to be intimidated by this evil force. So I went out and caught what must have been one of the very last buses to go into town. There were only two other women on the bus, and they were saying that they had to go into town because they had a relative at a hospital who was dangerously ill. As the bus approached the city centre, we passed an IRA Republican area. And our driver noticed that the bus just ahead of us had been set on fire. So he swerved his bus right around in the middle of the road and he said, well, that's it. If anyone wants to get off the bus, they better do it right now, because I'm taking this bus back to the depot. They're not going to burn my bus. Well, I was the only person to get off the bus. And I didn't feel a bit brave. Because when I got off the bus, I saw that the situation was much worse than I thought. There were several buses burning and some cars. And there were little side streets which I had thought I could cut through. But the army were there and they had cordoned off all these side streets on this side of the road, which I had considered safe. And the army had taken up the flagstones from the sidewalk, and they'd made themselves a little wall. And they were on their knees, crouching and shooting at a double-decker bus. And when I looked on top of this bus, which was burning, there were two masked gunmen, and they were shooting back down at the army. And the only possible way that I should get to my destination was through an archway of bullets. And at first I thought, well, that's it, I'm going home. And I started to walk home, and then I thought, just a minute, Myrtle, what about the message you got this morning? It is wrong to allow yourself to be intimidated by any evil force. Do you believe that message, or do you not? And I thought, no, I believe that message. That message could only have come to me from God. I never read it anywhere before. I never heard it. It was a clear directive from God. The thought came, well then, trust in that. Put your hand into God's. Well, I proceeded to walk towards the archway of bullets. And I heard a soldier shouting, where did she come from? And another one tried to pull my coat to pull me down in the road. He was shouting, get down, get down. But I walked on right through the archway of bullets. And as soon as I got in there, I felt as if I were engulfed in love, in a big archway of love. And I remember thinking, this must have been what it was like for the children of Israel. The Red Sea didn't open up until they got their feet right in there. And I felt very safe and loved and secure. I walked on, and the main street in our city center was absolutely empty. There wasn't a shop open. There wasn't a bus. There wasn't even another person. It was like that old movie, High Noon. You remember that? Well, it was very similar to that. But I remember thinking, well, I'll have a nice chance to be quiet and to think about this a bit more. And as I was walking up that street, I began to think, what is really going on here? Why did that IRA hunger striker allow himself to die? And the thought came back, he believed in a cause. And for a minute I felt such compassion for him, because I wondered, could I die for my cause? I love my cause, but would I be prepared to die for it? At least he had the courage to die for his own convictions. And I was able to pray for him and pray that his death would not be in vain. And then these words from the Christian Science textbook came to me very clearly. There is but one primal cause. Therefore, there can be no effect from any other cause. And there can be no reality in aught which does not proceed from this great and only cause. Now, these are words of the Christian Science textbook that I am very familiar with, and I'm sure you are too. But that day I saw them in a completely new context. I never saw them that way before. And I began to think, why, that's the truth. The IRA are not a genuine cause, or any terrorist group. No matter how much they believe they are not, because God is love, and God never caused terrorism. This cause was founded in hundreds of years of bigotry, hatred, fear, intolerance, and bloodshed. Therefore, it could not be of God. And because it was not, it would have no effect. It couldn't hold me or the people of my province up to ransom. It couldn't dictate terms to us and tell us how we should live, how we should live, or what we would do with our day. By this time I had reached the Christian Science reading room, and I turned the key in the door, and I heard a noise from a store across the way that had been bombed maybe a half an hour before I got there. All the windows were blown in and they were closed everywhere. The front door was blown right off. And I noticed a man come out of the back of the shop. And he had a piece of cardboard and a hammer and a nail. And he went to a little piece of doorpost that was still standing. And he nailed it up. And I could see that in big letters he had written, "Business as usual." And I thought, well, good for you. You've got the message too. So I went into the reading room and sat down and prayed some more. And I began to think then about the people who had heard the same news bulletin as I had. The people who were praying together with me, not only in my province, but probably in Britain and maybe in America, who had heard that too, were praying with me, perhaps in their homes or in their churches. I didn't know where. But I began to realize what a power that was. And that we, the people of Northern Ireland, were tuned into that. That power, that prayer, had all the power there was. That hatred and violence and ignorance and intolerance and bombs and guns and missiles were not power. They were powerless. But that prayer was truly effective. And I'm sure you have felt it in the last few weeks. We all felt that in spite of the war, the people of the world were united in prayer, whether we were friend or foe, and the whole world must have been feeling that. Well, after I prayed this way and I felt so uplifted and joyous, I began to hear noises outside. And I looked through the window and I saw some of the big stores opening. Then I saw buses coming back in and people coming back into town. And do you know that I had the busiest day in our reading room that I've ever had? People were coming in from all walks of life and saying, "We just came in to pray with you for our province." And when I got home in the evening and watched the news on television, it seemed that everything the IRA had planned to do that day had been stopped in its tracks. Bombs were found in the boots of cars. They were found with ammunition. There were many arrests made. And after that, I wasn't afraid anymore. I began to have the courage of my convictions. I began to apply that truth to everything in my life, that it's wrong to allow yourself to be intimidated by any evil force. I began to go to church and always made my way there from that time. I found it much easier to cope with the situation. It was interesting that the war didn't end on that day, but I had changed an awful lot. You know, in America you only hear about the bad things that are happening in our province. But believe me, there's an awful lot of good happening there. We've got a lovely new city, lovely new shops. All the big shops from London are coming over. The city centre is open now. It's been open for about 4 years. The theatres, the cinemas are all alive again. And even on our buses and cars, we have stickers, and they say, "Belfast is buzzing." And the people there are so happy that we're able to go out, that even when it's late night shopping, people go into the city center because there's such a carnival atmosphere. And anyone who comes there to perform in any of the arts says that we are the best audience in the world because we're so grateful to be able to go to a live show and do all these things. Recently I saw a program on television, and it said that a landmine had been left on a country road for two jeep loads of soldiers who were to pass by it at 3 p.m. And it had been primed to go off at that time. And it said that a cow came along and chewed through the tripwire so that the bomb was defused. And I thought how wonderful it was that God used a cow. We've some lovely cows in Ireland. Many things like that are happening. We've had so many bombs defused in Northern Ireland by the security forces. And if all those bombs had gone off, I don't think I'd be here today. I don't think there'd be many of us left. So although you may think things seem to be slow, this war is going on a long time, believe me, there's a lot of good going on and a lot of people getting together. Now, from that experience, I learned what moral courage was all about. There's a difference between animal courage and moral courage. There were times when the situation in our country was so bad that I felt I wanted to go out and take on the IRA single-handed because I would feel so frustrated. But I knew that that wasn't the answer. So that day I learned that moral courage is really having a deeper understanding of God, a humble trust in Him, the ability to pray to Him, to really listen, and then put our hand in His and go forward. That's what moral courage is really all about. And terrorism can take so many forms. We can be terrorized by the fear of death, by old age, by loneliness, by lack or debt, or things that are happening in our community or in our world. But as you and I face up to our fears and apply this moral courage of deepening our trust in God, we will be helping, really helping, to overcome. They feel they have to do what their friends are doing, that they have to go along with the crowd or else they're not popular. And they think that their friends are so special and wonderful that there really isn't any harm in what they're doing. But the Ten Commandments are not outdated. They will never become unnecessary or old-fashioned, and neither will the Sermon on the Mount. I learned about this through an experience I had with one of my daughters. She had just finished boarding school. She was only 19 at the time, and she didn't know what to do about furthering her education. And we had just gone to live in England, where we lived for a year. And she had left all her friends in boarding school, and we lived in a very small town in the Yorkshire Dales. And she didn't know any young people. She decided to take a year out until she made up her mind what she wanted to do about further schooling. And she took a job in a jewelry shop in town. And she met a young man who asked her to go out with him. He had a very nice car, And he used to come along for her in the evening and take her out in his car. But the only place he ever took her to was a pub. You call them pubs over here? Bars, yeah, to a bar. That's the only place he ever took her to. And I noticed that each time he came to our door, I would open the door to him. I could smell drink that he had been drinking. Now, I wasn't happy about the situation. I knew that she didn't drink. But she went out to the bar with him. He had already drink taken. Then he had more drink, and he was driving my daughter home. I tried to talk to her about it. But this was the first boyfriend she'd gone out with. And she told me to stop preaching, that he knew what she was doing. Well, one day she came home at lunchtime, and I had had a phone call from a friend of ours, a young woman, to tell us she just got engaged to be married. Now, this young friend had had so many boyfriends that you wouldn't have believed it. And we couldn't believe she was finally getting married. So my daughter said, well, I'm going to go out and buy her an engagement card, and I'll bring it back and we both sign it. And she said she'd post it on her way to work. Well, she came back and she said, Mum, where do you see this card? It's hilarious. On the front was a picture of a big green toad. And it said underneath, you have to kiss a lot of toads. And inside it says, before you meet your handsome prince. Now, we thought this was very funny and right up her street. And we both signed it and sent it off to her. But when my daughter went back to work in the afternoon, I began to think, you know, that's really very unfunny. To think that there's a law that says you have to do the rounds, that you have to kiss a lot of toads before you meet Mr. Wonderful or Miss Wright. And I thought that's a man-made belief and law, and my daughter does not have to be subjected to that. So I began to pray about it. And I could see that her real need was to see more of God's qualities around her in her life. And she had a right to that. And that God could supply her need in a proper way. Well, when she came home in the evening, I told her about this. And she said, don't start preaching again. She said, he's coming round this evening and I'm going out with him. Well, he came round at his usual time, and off they went, and I felt very disappointed at first. And then I thought, I'm not going to be disappointed. She is God's child, and no matter where she is right now, doesn't matter if she's in the bar, God is there too. And God is her father and her mother, and she is God's child. And she can always hear God's voice. And God's child is obedient to God's voice. Well, about 3/4 of an hour later, she came home. And I said, where is the young man? She said, I told him I didn't want to go out with him anymore. And I said, why not? She said, because you're right, as usual. Then she went up to her bedroom, and after a few minutes I went up after her, and she was lying on her bed having a little cry. And I put my arms round her, and she said, Mom, you don't understand, but I'm very lonely. All my friends are still at school, and I don't know anybody here. And she said, he was better than nothing. And I said, well, do you want to settle for second best? She said, well, what do you suggest I do about it? I said, why don't you make out a list of all the qualities that you would like to see in a husband or a boyfriend. And then ask yourself, are you living those qualities? She said, I couldn't be bothered. You know the feeling? Yes. I see all the nodding heads. So I got a big notepad and I said, well, just tell me one quality that you would like to have in a husband or a boyfriend. She said he would have to be very, very loving and caring and tender and gentle. Hope you boys are listening. And gentle and understanding and forgiving and compassionate. Well, soon I'd finished the whole page just on love. And I said, well, can we get to something else that you'd like to say? She said, well, what about a sense of humor? He would have to have a sense of humor. And it would have to be good, clean humor. And she would like someone who could laugh at himself. Someone that they could laugh together about things. Well, we filled a whole page on that. Then she went on to principle. She would like someone who expressed a great deal of principle. He would have to be able to apply principle in his life, in his business affairs, in his relationships, in everything that he did. And he would have to have good morals. Well, she sat up and she was so excited by this. She said, I'll fill them in. And she was telling me what pages she did. And then at the end I said, I think that's enough. Would you like to read them out? So she read them all out to me. And then she said, Mommy, where would you find a man like that? I said, well, there must be one, because that's how God made man. Well, the next morning, she came down for breakfast, and it was her day off. She said she'd had a wonderful night thinking about this, and it really helped her, and she wanted to live these qualities too. She said, now what will we do with my day off? What would we do with her day off? And I said, well, there's a little antique shop near our church where I have been wanting to visit, and I needed to sell something. And I said, why don't we go to this little antique shop? She said, that's a good idea. I would like to see that too. And we went in there and we saw this very nice gentleman. I told him what I wanted to sell, and he was very interested and said that he was good looking as well. Well, they were engaged 3 months to the day they met, and they were married 1 year to the day they met. They've now been married for over 10 years, very happily, and are in business together. You see, this wasn't a case of me being her mother and dictating to her and telling her what to do. It was back to this moral courage, to having the courage to do something about it. It was a quiet listening to God to see that that card wasn't so funny really. And then to apply that in our lives and to trust my daughter to God's care, to a much, much better outcome. But it was interesting that that young man married soon after that, and he had stopped drinking. So he was blessed by the experience as well. And so I've been blessed in raising 5 children in Christian Science, because it has helped me to apply the rule of morality and moral courage in every situation in our lives, no matter what it is. That's the wonderful thing about the teachings of Christian Science. It's a whole way of life. It isn't just a matter of going to church on Sunday and praying. It's a complete way of life that we apply to everything and every situation. our Jesus Christ, or Christ Jesus, demonstrated more moral courage than any man that ever trod this earth. Any man. Because he knew that he truly was the Son of God. In other words, because he knew he was the Son of God, he listened to God and followed him and applied this same moral courage in his life. In his 3 short years of ministry on earth, he overcame every known law that there was in his time or ours. He overcame the law of lack when he provided wine at the wedding and when he fed the multitude. He overcame the law of gravity when he walked on the water. He overcame the laws of the element when he stilled a storm. He overcame every known disease in his time. He overcame death for others and finally for himself. And he did it through this same moral courage, through absolute trust in God. And he obeyed fearlessly even the cross and the crucifixion to prove to mankind that all these things could be put off here and now. Not when we die and go to heaven, but right here and right now in our day, in our time, and in our age. And he left instructions for us all to go out and do as he did. And even though he was the most famous man that ever lived, he never went to university. He never wrote a book. He never traveled far from his own home. He never had a proper home or family of his own. And yet, he was the greatest man that ever lived. And the world comes to a standstill every year to celebrate his birthday. When I listen to ads on television or see them in newspapers or whatever that tells people how to become a better man or a better woman, they usually say, smoke a certain brand of cigars or cigarettes, or use a certain aftershave, or drive a certain car, and that you become a man, or have so much money in the bank, and you become a man. But none of this has anything to do with becoming a man. If you want to become a better man, or a better person, you should use Jesus as your measuring stick. Because as you become more like him, you're becoming a better man. And if you or I, male or female, could ask ourselves every day, did I take one step today at becoming more like him? Because if you did, you're becoming a better man or a better woman, and we're helping to make a better earth. We are putting this moral courage into operation. Jesus was not afraid to oppose the laws, the traditions, the doctrines, the creeds of his day. He fearlessly obeyed God. Fearlessly. And that brought so much healing and love and redemption into the lives of we don't know how many people. Countless people. Not just the people that he met in his daily walk, what people ever said. I'm Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, was a close disciple of the Master's. From early childhood, she loved the Scriptures. And although she had a very difficult life, she had very poor health, was a very frail young woman all her life, and even lost her young son, who had to be fostered out because her husband had died and she was left with no money and no home. She still believed in God and had a deep thirst to find out the truth about God and man's relationship to him. And in spite of all her struggles, she kept on with this quest for truth. And at an age when most people, especially women, would be wanting to take it easy in life, she just began to live. She began to have better health in this quest for God. And finally, after much years of study of the Bible, concordances and dictionaries, she wrote this book, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures. And if anyone here this evening has never read this book, you can have a free copy afterwards by applying to any of the ushers. Or purchase your own copy, and I can assure you it'll be the best investment you've ever made. It was the best investment I've ever made. And after she wrote that book, she wrote many other books. Then she established her own church, her own worldwide movement, and her own publishing society to publish her own writings. And in her 87th year, she also published the Christian Science Monitor. Look what she did for women. I mean, that was 100 years ago. Even now today, the churches are fighting to allow women to become ministers or priests. And yet here was a woman over 100 years ago who established her own church and a whole worldwide movement. I don't think any woman before ever demonstrated and practiced so much moral courage as she did. And yet her moral courage was humility. She was so humble. She walked with God. She listened to his voice and trusted in him. Now, there's another aspect of moral courage that I would like to touch upon before I leave you this evening. And that is having the courage to turn to God completely for healing, whether for ourselves or for our children. As you know, as you've heard, I have 5 children. And my children were brought up without the need for doctors. Only one, my eldest boy, once had to have a doctor because of the law of the land and because of the school. But they never needed doctors. We worked everything out through the teachings of Christian Science. And sometimes that's a difficult thing to do. It can take a lot of moral courage. And it's the same with us. If we have a physical problem that we've had for a long time, and it doesn't appear to be healing, and sometimes it takes a lot of moral courage to be able to rely entirely on God for that healing, especially if we have relatives around us who are anxious about it. Well, I would like to tell you about a healing I had in the last year. This is not the usual story I tell in this lecture, but this healing has meant so much to me and been so wonderful but I would like to share it with you. When you are asked to address any subject publicly, I have found from my own experience that you're always called upon to demonstrate what you're talking about. And my subject being moral courage and how do we obtain it, I find that I had to have moral courage when I had a severe physical problem. At the last January, at the beginning of my new lecture tour, it was just about a week before I was going out to lecture, and I had many lectures all up and down Great Britain. I was putting some milk bottles on my doorstep for the milkman, and the doorstep was wet, and I fell. And I broke three bones in my foot, and one of the milk bottles was broken and cut a vein on my foot. And the vein became poisoned, and I suffered an awful lot of pain. And although I myself had been healed three times of broken bones, this time, although I prayed and I had very good help and support from a dear friend who was helping me, this did not seem to yield. And I began to realize that this was something that was trying to keep me from going out and giving my lectures. So I was determined that I was going out no matter what. Well, I went and I did many lectures under very difficult circumstances. It was very difficult for me indeed, and I was in an awful lot of pain, and I had to walk on a stick. And it was also difficult because so many people saw the problem. It wasn't something that I could hide. Well, it went on for several months, and after about 4 months, we had a heat wave in Britain, and I had many lectures 1 week, and I was staying with some friends, and I was completely bedridden. And we had called in a Christian Science nurse to dress the foot, and when she looked at the foot, she felt that really I should not go out lecturing anymore, that I should stay at home or enter a Christian Science nursing home. And my friend agreed. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I can't agree with you. And you may think that it's human will, but I think that is the purpose behind it, that evil would try to stop the good that I'm doing and try to stop me, make me think I couldn't prove the truth about moral courage. And I saw that I had to still believe in that message that I got from God, that it was wrong to allow myself to be intimidated by an evil force. So I decided I was not going to be intimidated. I was going to finish my course with joy, as the Bible says. Well, that night I was in extreme pain, and it looked like I wouldn't be able to travel the next day. And I hadn't had any sleep for many nights. I didn't want to cause any noise in the house. And I sat up on the end of the bed, but I was crying because I was so tired and in so much pain. And suddenly, I crossed my legs and I took this foot on my knee. And I began to think about gratitude. And actually, I began to think about Thanksgiving Square in Dallas, because I'd been there before, and I love the idea of Thanksgiving Square. I know the power of gratitude. I proved it so often. So I decided I'm going to be grateful for that foot. And I took my foot on my knee, and I stroked it gently. And I said, foot, do you know that I'm grateful for you? I love you, foot. I said, after all, you helped me to take my first steps when I was a baby. And when I was a little girl, you helped me to go out to play. You helped me through all my years at school, and I'm grateful for that. And when I was a teenager and a young woman, do you remember how we went dancing, and we had some great times together? Well, I'm grateful for all those years. You've taken me lots of places, but, and really, I'm so grateful for you. I don't know how I could manage without you. And I began to think how grateful I really was for a foot, for feet. How we take all this for granted every day. We never stop to think about it until suddenly you haven't got it. So I said, I really love you, foot. And although I know you're really a spiritual idea, because that's how God sees you, right now I can only see a human foot. And I'm grateful for you, for whatever it is you represent. And I really thank God for that foot and loved it and stroked it. And do you know, it was like somebody had defused a bomb. I became so calm and so peaceful that I got into bed and I went fast asleep. Now the pain left at that stage, and the complete healing of the foot didn't come for 2 months after that. But each day I walked more freely and more easily, and I didn't have to cancel one lecture. And it was interesting to note that the complete healing didn't take place until my lecture year had finished. But I was so grateful for it and for that healing. It showed me again that this was another way that I had to use moral courage. And the moral courage, again, was listening to God, not to what human opinions were telling, but listening to Him, putting my hand into His hand, trusting in Him, and knowing that God, the Creator of all, really loved His creation. I almost forgot to tell you, after I had said to the foot how much I loved it and how grateful I was to it, I then said to the foot, what would you be without me, foot? If someone cut you off, what would you be? You'd be a dead foot. So do you want to be a dead foot, or will you and I glorify the Father's name together? And it was nice to see that we did that. And I know that no matter what your problem is, no matter how bad you think it is, or how long you've had it, I know that you're God's child. I know that you're precious to Him. I know that He made you. He created you. He cares for every little bit of you. Everything. And He cares for your family and your loved ones and your business and your country and your world. And if you could just see that more clearly every day and trust in it, put your hand in His hand and really follow through and obey that, then you and I, all of us together, will be developing such moral courage that we will help to cement and create a better world for all mankind to live in. Thank you so much for being such a lovely audience.